A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 69. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about the Year of the Sex Olympics. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, we're talking about the future of television and what type of society does this future television broadcast to? And an old favourite of British Invaders, it's Nigel Neal giving us a glimpse of the future way back in the 1960s. And as we go along, you may be surprised to hear how many of his predictions about television have come true.
There were certainly some interesting things in the Year of the Sex Olympics. It was a 1968 BBC teleplay, 103 minutes long, that was a single one-off broadcast. And it had some very interesting themes in it with lots of social commentary. It shares some ideas with 1984. It is said that it predicted reality TV in some ways. And it had lots of interesting things to say about television and media and sex in the media and how that media was used.
Yeah, that's right. It does have quite a lot of stuff to say. I mean, Nigel Neal was really writing about television at this stage, and he had some interesting observations which he brings out in this rather strange little TV play that we're talking about.
It is rather strange. I'm not aware of anything else quite like this.
Yeah, it's an unusual one, but it's quite it is quite fun, as you'll find as we go along. So if we get up into the setup of the film, it's called The Year of the Sex Olympics, and at some point in the future, rather enticingly teased right in the very initial caption on the screen, where it says sooner than you think, which is quite a neat way for Nigel Neal to set this up. And we see a group of television executives, directors and producers, and they're producing their live television show, which is going out, and it's all about the Sex Olympics. So we see smiling, cheerful, rather scantily clad contestants who are going to appear in this television show called The Year of the Sex Olympics.
It seems almost a bit like competitive ballroom dancing, but competitive on display sex or something like that.
That's very much it. That's what seems to be set up. Now, obviously, this is a 1960s TV show, so we don't get to see what the audience of this particular television show get to see. We just get to see some of the establishing shots where the various contestants are being introduced.
But they do make it clear that there is this type of competition there, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also get the idea that television dominates everything. It is not only how people get their information, it is how people live their lives. You have a small group of people who are the elite, they call them high drives, who essentially control the masses through the media. They run this television system and send out this media that everyone watches all of the time. And it is basically the way to keep everyone else, to keep the masses calm and docile and just prevent people from causing trouble by beaming out sort of mindless television that they watch all the time.
Yeah, that's it. As you say, we've got the high drives controlling the masses, who they refer to as low drives, and using television as what they call apathy control. Because they found that they can control people's emotions and lower sexual and aggressive urges just by broadcasting television and giving the low drives a constant stream of sex and violence on television. And that's what keeps them under control and seems to control the whole society.
That's essentially it. And the things that they broadcast to them are things like the Sex Olympics itself and something called Art Sex, and also the Hungry Angry Show, which appears to be a competition of people throwing what looks like cream pie filling or some type of slop at each other. And, meant to be sort of lowbrow humor and violence wrapped into one. And this was part of what they were doing as well. So these were the kinds of things that they were broadcasting out to everyone all of the time.
Yes, we should mention the Hungry Angry Show, shouldn't we? Because these contestants throw in food at each other and also eat in food, and prizes for those who gain the most weight or something. It's very bizarre.
It is very odd.
So we have this strange society that Nigel Neal sets up for us very early on in the show. That we can see it's all about television, and it's all about the programs that were going out on the television, and it's all about these high drives and the low drives. And we've got some other bits and pieces of the society that we sort of, I think, pick up on quite quickly, Brian.
Yes.
He certainly sets it up quickly. So we have a slightly unusual speech pattern, or a sort of strange abbreviated jargon-based speech, which is, I suppose, similar or sort of rings bells to us for Newspeak from 1984. And it takes a little while to get used to it and to sort of get an ear for what they're saying to each other.
It does. It's very fast. Some of them, some of the people in the main control room there speak very quickly in this sort of abbreviated way, where they're often dropping verbs and prepositions and things. So it's just this very quick stream of speech, but you do start picking up on it as you listen to it.
Yes. I mean, after a few minutes, we start to catch the rhythm of their speech and understand what they're talking about. We see that this society, they all seem to live indoors. That both the high drives and the low drives all live indoors in very carefully controlled environments. And certainly the high drives seem to want for nothing. But like any controlled society, I suppose we do catch glimpses from time to time that there is a security police force. And when certain incidents happen, we do see glimpses of the police appearing to control things even further.
Yes, there is a lot that is controlled in the society, including reproduction. And this is part of the idea of these shows like the Sex Olympics and Art Sex, is that this is the outlet for a lot of sexual urges and so on. And people are not normally reproducing except in this sort of organized ways with the high drives, the elite, where they are sort of prescribing who should have children and when. And there is no concept of family, and there is no concept of parents raising children or anything like that. It's all sort of done as a mechanical thing, with arranges being made. And there is lots of hedonism and sex and drugs elsewhere, but it is not about reproduction. And having children is something that is very much separated from anything related to sex and the want for sex. We also have the idea that other things that TV stands in for are not there. There is still reading. People still read, but very little. And there is no art outside of television. So you have this idea when someone talks about pictures and someone else says, well, how can they be pictures if they're not moving? How can something that's still and not a TV thing be a picture? So there are lots of these things that are sort of a little strange in this society, but it actually, the way that it's set up, it plays quite well. I like that sort of world building that's in this.
He does a very good job of building this world, Nigel Neal, the writer. As you say, we quickly pick up on this, and this idea, as you say, that only the moving image on television means anything to them, and that other concepts seem very strange and alien. So we've got this society of the high drives and the low drives, but again, as we learn early on in this show, something's not quite right. There are problems starting to creep in, and in particular, the sort of controlling effects of television on the low drives may be wearing off, and the low drives seem to be losing their interest in sex and violence on television. And so the elites are sort of looking for something new, maybe a new trend in television to help them keep control. But also, I think one or two of the elites are also starting to have questions themselves about what's going on, Brian.
Yes, that's right. And these questions about the low drives and how effective the television as control is working, there is some ambiguity there about how imminent this problem is. They're looking for something else in what they do, but how serious the problem is, we don't really know.
Sportsex presents Tonight and Every Night.
Here we go again, Butters and Cottis. Comfy and cozy are you all? Tonight we've got lots of real supporting talent for you, so keep your eyes with us. Remember, all scores in this special new Sportsex series counts towards the Sex Olympics, the Jumbo World Event.
This is the year of the Sex Olympics. Sex Olympics here.
So keep looking. Maybe tonight's winners make it to the Olympics. First round, men.
Now, there are a few key characters in the Year of the Sex Olympics. Among them, the central character, Nat Mender, played by Tony Vogel, is the producer of the Sex Olympics show, troubled by his age, his relationship to his daughter, and his daughter's mother. He doesn't really have a relationship with his daughter's mother, but there is this sort of connection because of this 9-year-old daughter. And he is concerned about some of these issues and doesn't know where to go with his life and what's happening, and he's beginning to have doubts about his role as this television producer. He is a little bit like Winston Smith from 1984. I don't think he is as troubled as Winston Smith, but he is sort of realizing that he needs something other than the job and the role that is specified for him.
Yes, he has doubts and worries, doesn't he?
Yes.
He, as you said, Brian, he has a daughter, and the daughter's mother is a character called Deanie Webb, played by an actress called Suzanne Neave, who I think we glimpsed briefly when we watched the TV show UFO, where she played Commander Straker's ex-wife.
Oh, yes.
Deanie Webb is another high drive. She's another TV producer. She's a producer on the Hungry Angry show that we mentioned. And as we say, she is the mother of Nat's daughter. But there is this whole thing that there's no relationships between involved in sex and reproduction. So although they produce this daughter, they rarely see each other. And when they do, their conversations are rather awkward and stilted at first.
And they don't see the daughter all that much either.
Because children are raised in sort of nurseries by specialist nurses, I think. And they're occasionally sort of brought out and produced and placed in front of their parents. But it's all very strange and sterile and lacking in any emotion, I think, Brian.
Yes, it is. And they test the children to determine if they're high drive or low drive. There are sort of some interesting elements there. Deanie also has some concerns of her own about the system and is also questioning the role she's given, so to speak.
And as you've probably gathered from what we've saying so far, this is very much a society based on youth, and all the characters are quite young, and we don't see many older characters. But one we do encounter is coordinator Hugo Priest, who was played by the actor Leonard Rossiter, familiar to British TV viewers as Reginald Perrin from the show later on. And Hugo Priest is an older high drive, an older member of the elite. As his title suggests, he's the sort of coordinator of a variety of television shows. So he oversees the Sex Olympics and the Hungry Angry show and many others. And he remembers a bit more about how things used to be and some of the reasons why they had to start controlling the low drives, and how they developed ways of doing that through television, and how they're still looking for new ways to do the same. So he provides a bit more insight for us into the society, and his conversations with Nat Mender give us some more clues as to what's going on and what is going on.
Yes, Hugo Priest is really the only character that has perspective in this. He remembers what they call old times, which is basically our society, or a society very close to ours. and no one else remembers anything other than what they have there at the time. I think there was reference to the life expectancy for high drives being something like 35. These are not people who live a long time. So he is this one character who brings us that sense of perspective and knows what used to happen beforehand.
It reminds me in places a bit of Logan's Run, the movie, in that we don't see many characters over the age of 30. And the younger characters have got this rather sort of strange concept of what it's like to be over 30.
Yes, there are elements of that. We also have a character called Lazar Opie, played by none other than Brian Cox, who went on to do many, many films. Lazar Opie is Nat's colleague, and I believe his junior, like an assistant of a sort for him.
I think so, like an assistant director on the show.
That's the idea, yeah. And he is very ambitious, and he is a believer in the system. He completely agrees with the way that they're doing things. He wants to push things even further away from our society and away from individualism, where some of the other characters might be wondering about stepping backwards.
Yes, he's driving on with it. And as you say, he's a true believer and he's ambitious and quite, I think, quite nasty in a way. We see a nasty streak to him. And he has no doubts about what he's doing. He's just getting on with it, isn't he?
Yes. As the program goes on, there's a bit of a dichotomy in points of view and a contrast between Opie and Hugo Priest. So you have the older person who remembers the old times, and you have the younger person who does not, who have two very different ways of seeing things.
Absolutely, yes.
I know what sex is.
She knows. I mean sports sex, like it gotta be. Now look at those other twos. Super King Buddies, the toppest in the area. Move and lovely. Look at that two. See that? Look at that. That pretty, that style, clean action.
She not so pretty.
I think not. To that, yes. To that, obviously, she's like the toppest in the area. See the ratings?
They got a feel. I cannot do like that. Not even try. Sex is not to do. Sex is to watch.
So at this point, we normally talk about the production notes. So for the year of the Sex Olympics, BBC Two was running a series of television plays which ran from 64 to 1968, which was known as Theatre 625. And that referred to the new higher definition TV broadcasts, which were only going out on BBC Two at that time, which had 625 lines on the television screen. So this was the 1960s equivalent of HD, I suppose, Brian.
That's right.
And as part of the Theatre 625 strand, they'd included another production of Nigel Neal's script for 1984. Now, that was first produced in 1954, and we discussed it back on British Invaders 59 and 60, and we liked it a lot, and the BBC liked it so much that they actually did another production of the same script, which went out in 1965. Sadly, like most of the Theatre 625 strand of films, that version is lost to us and doesn't survive. But luckily, we do have this particular film that we're discussing.
Yes. It would be really interesting to see that production of 1984, but unfortunately, it's no longer available.
Yeah.
1984 was successful when they ran this then new production in 1965. So the BBC approached Nigel Neal for a brand new story for Theatre 625. And initially, he rejected that idea because he was still unhappy about what happened with the Quatermass films, because Nigel Neal had created and written Quatermass for the BBC, and the BBC sold film adaptation rights to Hammer Films. Hammer made these Quatermass films, and the BBC got that licensing money, and Nigel Neal apparently didn't get any of it. So the Director General, Hugh Carlton Green, found out about the situation and talked to Neil and arranged an extra payment specifically to recognize the success of Quatermass. So I guess it was a bit of a peace offering in place of the original fees that Neil had hoped for. And based on that, they continued forward, and Neil looked at these ideas about the future and issues in society, and these ideas of the controlling society that was feared very much at the time. But also he was looking at the sort of reactionary counterculture movement from the late 60s, and he was looking at sort of his take on that and his almost satire of parts of that. So he wrote a script based on that, which was accepted in 1967 and handed to a director, Michael Elliott, who was working with the BBC.
But before they could start actually shooting the script, something interesting happened. And I love it when some of our regulars on British Invaders crop up again, because another familiar name, Mary Whitehouse, got involved, because somehow or other she got hold of a copy of Nigel Neal's script for the Year of the Sex Olympics. So I presume, Brian, she must have had a mole working within the BBC.
Probably.
And yes. And as ever, she raised objections and tried to get the production of the television show blocked. But fortunately for us, the Director General, Mr. Carlton Green, as one of his regular battles with Mary Whitehouse that was going on through the 60s, ignored her protests and gave the go-ahead for the production to begin. Now, we've talked about Mary Whitehouse before, because she was the chair of an organisation that was trying to protect viewers' rights, and she had very strong views about the type of material that was broadcast on British television. And she's objected to several other shows that we've talked about in the past. But what's quite interesting in a way about her objections here is that one possible reading of Nigel Neal's script is that almost that he's agreeing with her about her views about sex and violence on television and the pervasive effect of that. So it seems strange in a way that she was objecting.
It does seem a little strange. She was very well known for objecting to inappropriate material on television, whether it be of a violent nature very often, or a sexual nature, or things that she felt were unchristian in one way or another. And I suspect that when she saw the script, she was overreacting a little bit because she probably didn't know how to read a script that well. So I suspect that she was thinking there were things that would be shown in the program that never would have been shown in the program. That's just a guess on my part.
Right, okay. That she probably thought there'd be more of the actual Sex Olympics up on screen. Or maybe she just objected to the word sex in the title.
Quite possibly, with Mary Whitehouse, that is definitely a possibility. Or the fact that, you know, the idea of there being such a thing as Sex Olympics and these sort of competitive voyeuristic activities that were envisioned in here was simply something that shouldn't even be discussed in something broadcast, I guess.
Possibly, yes. But anyway, she's interesting. She's cropped up again. We've mentioned her before because of her objections to the war game and to the Omega Factor. And of course, she was very famously critical of much of the Tom Baker era on Doctor Who, I think, Brian.
Yes, starting even earlier than that, at least in the John Pertwee era, I believe.
Right.
And she had things to say about Robin of Sherwood as well. So there have been many of these things that that she raised objections to.
Anyway, the BBC did ignore her objections and did go ahead with the production.
Yes, they did. The location shooting for the outdoor scenes took place on the Isle of Man, which, as it happens, was Nigel Neal's birthplace. And they moved into Ealing Film Studios to shoot interiors. There were some delays due to strike action, but they were able to relaunch to complete all of the scenes as needed.
And then it was broadcast in colour in this higher definition format on BBC Two in July 1968, and it went out at about 9:30, I think, so after the 9 o'clock watershed. And as we say, this was a colour production, which unfortunately the colour version doesn't survive, because as was BBC policy at the time, the colour tape was very precious and was later wiped and reused, and so only a black and white tele-recording of the show survives, and that's what we've been watching for this episode of British Invaders.
It's actually fairly lucky that we even have a black and white version. As much as I would love to see what this looked like in color, I'm glad to be able to have a black and white copy that still exists so we can look at this and see what type of production it was.
Yes, we'll talk about this a bit more in our next episode, about some of the look of this particular show, the Year of the Sex Olympics. But there are certain elements of it that must have been quite fantastic and fantastical in color. So that will probably wrap it up for our first episode. Please come back and join us for the second part, when we're going to continue talking about the story and how the high drives look to develop a new television format. We're going to go on and talk about some of the reactions to the play after it was first broadcast and since. And of course, we've got to get on and do our own particular reactions and our the good and the bad and our reviews and recommendations.
Yes, there is a wonderful sense of social commentary in this, and commentary on all sorts of different things, and that's something that we will have fun looking into next time for sure. So you can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Please come back and join us next time. Until then, this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.